What did Jerry observe at Trump's inauguration? And we should focus on the trend, not the noise.
This is Jerry Tumas Smart Money, a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services with Cornerstone President and Founder, Jerry Tumas. Jerry Tumas is a certified financial planner. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member, FINRA, and SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, or unaffiliated entities. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tumas Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. We are here to talk about your finances, investments, and the economy, and we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.
Welcome to Smart Money with Jerry Tumas. This is Michael Williams. Well, Jerry, you got to go on a little trip this past weekend to D.C. and observe the inauguration. We're very interested to learn what you got to see out there.
Yeah, it was a fun trip overall. My wife, as most of you probably know, she's still recovering from stroke and cancer and stuff like that. So she's doing good around the house, but that was too much of a trip for her. So I took my daughter, Hannah. She's a high-end realtor in the McKinney area. She works the whole Dallas area. But she's also a business entrepreneur. That's the way she thinks about the business and the world. And I wanted her there to help kind of network with some of the people that we know from Washington and some of the people that are a part of the Trump administration. So it was a good trip. I really enjoyed it, except for the ice. I did fall here. I messed up. I did not avoided the ice. Falling on the ice, and we went to a restaurant, and it was real dark inside, and they had a funky step. And in the meantime, the windows were wide open, and it was brilliant light from the snow and the remnants of the snow and the sun coming out. Anyway, so I tripped, stubbed my toe. So hence, I'm doing remote broadcast today. Anyway, but I'll be good. It turned out it's just a sprain and not a broken, even though it looked like it was broken. So, but that's what happened. It was not fun walking through the airport on the way home, though, but I'm good to go. Here's the interesting things to me is I stand back and look at this from the first time. We attended the first Trump inauguration, stood out on the lawn for gazillion hours when they were doing the inauguration, you know, from the Capitol steps last two times ago with Trump. The interesting thing to me, I actually enjoyed, I could see a whole lot better. We ended up, because of the snow, they changed the venue entirely. We ended up watching it from a big screen TV inside the hotel we were staying at. And I'm like, okay, but actually I could see a whole lot better than being, you know, 400 miles away, quote unquote, you know, looking at it live. But the interesting thing to me about this, and I've spent a lot of time, there's a researcher, he's actually with the Hoover Institute. His name escapes me. I'm even thinking we might want to try to get this guy on a radio interview here in the near future. But he's an expert on World War II. He was an expert on Trump. And he made a couple of three comments, and I thought they were very appreciative. If you look at, you know, the term kiss his ring comes to mind, because if you look at Trump and he's standing there, coincidentally, all of the people, and I don't know if this is a matter of protocol, if this is always the way they do it, but all the ex-presidents and presidents' wives and so forth were on the far left, the left. Yeah, they were on the left, Trump's left. And the rest of the business community, which before now has really not embraced Trump. You know, it was politically incorrect. It was not popular to embrace Trump and what he was doing in his first series as president. And I think in reality, the fact that he was gone for 4 years makes him even much more effective this time. Now, a lot of the problems he's inherited are much worse than they were back then in terms of the national debt. We'll talk about that sometime in the program. But if you look at on his right, our left, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Kennedy's there, Zuckerberg, he's got all these industrial leaders, Larry Ellison. He's got all these people that are high-end business people. One of the Fox commentators, I don't remember who it was during the inaugurational speech when he was talking and they had a break. He said, I really believe that some of these people have just awakened to the fact that they can't continue to run businesses profitably with the type of regime, the direction, the way we were headed. So in other words, A, did they just capitulate to the pressure? Did the Bezos of the world and the Zuckerbergs of the world, did they just decide, okay, well, he's the king now, we got to support the king, even though I don't agree with him, I hate him, because that's kind of how all of it was before. The guy from the Hoover Institute essentially said most of the people that were in his previous administration, on the surface, they tried to, they acted like they supported him, but privately behind the scenes, they didn't want to appear to be a supporter of Trump, and they didn't want that to affect their career later on. So they would try to undercut things, they would passively resist and things like that. And I think that's one of the things that got him so frustrated in his first administration. I think this one's going to be completely different. I believe he's brought in a whole lot of outsiders that are not a part of the Washington hardcore permanent bureaucracy type thinkers and the royalty, if you want to call them that. But the bottom line is he's bringing in a lot of outside speakers. I'm excited about Elon Musk, and I hope he does do a great job of cutting government waste. What we have to do, though, is we have to be positive about the positives we're seeing. We have to be realistic about the long run. And we, you know, Michael, we quote the book From Good to Great a lot. And one of the things in Good to Great book, which I, in my opinion, may be the most important business book that's of my lifetime, is what I would believe. They said, and of course, this was taken from, the original quote was taken from one of the guys that was the top ranked prisoner of war during the Vietnam era. He was an admiral. And they basically said, what you have to do to survive, he said, first of all, the people that were just blind optimists that said, hey, we're going to be out of here shortly, and it's all, you know, everything's great. The people that were just blind optimists, he said, those people were the first to die. This was Admiral Stockdale, who was the one that Ross Perot picked as his running mate back when Ross Perot was running for president. And Admiral Stockdale, again, was the highest ranked prisoner of war. I've forgotten what, I think he was, I want to say 4-star. I don't know. I wasn't in the Navy, but anyway, he was an admiral in the Navy. I guess it's not stars. I guess it's a different ranking system. Bottom line, though, he was an admiral. And they said when they interviewed him, how did the people survive and what happened during the prisoner of war time? And he said, we had to be brutally honest in our assessment of our current reality while have unwavering faith that we prevail in the end. And that's where I believe America is right now. The good news to me is I think that the country got a full-blown taste of what will happen if we let the far left take over. Well, not a full-blown taste, because they didn't have enough power to really do everything they wanted. You got to see, it was kind of like an appetizer. You go to a nice restaurant, you get the appetizer. We got to see the appetizer, what the far left will do to America if they're left unchecked, if they become the party of power. And I think it would be significantly worse, obviously, if they had gotten everything they wanted. There were a lot of restraining voices, a lot of restraint from the Republicans having at least partial power during that time. But the bottom line is Trump's going full bore. You know, all systems go. He has nothing to lose. He's been shot at. They attempted to take his life. He has 4 years to go. He knows it's only 4 years, so he's going to press the pedal to the metal. And he's also a lot more wise than he was back then. I think he understands the forces that would try to resist him. I think that a lot of the forces that would not have cooperated before are now in full cooperation, thinking, okay. And again, the commentator, the Fox commentator, and I didn't catch his name, he commented, he said, hey, bottom line is a lot of these big leaders in the tech area in particular, but a lot of the newer companies, you know, the Elon Musk, the Kennedys, the Zuckerberg, people like that, they kind of realize, hey, we cannot run a corporation. We cannot maximize this. We cannot have freedom of speech. There, you know, Zuckerberg, I watched a video of him, it was about 10 minutes long, where he explained, and I was surprised at two things about Zuckerberg. Number one, the humility he exhibited when he was talking. He was kind of sheepish. He was kind of chagrined. He was like, you could tell he was in regret. He's like, I'm not happy about what I'm going to tell you. He said, but what I am going to tell you is that I was told by the Biden administration to cut certain things out. And now he's, to part of it, to me, is kind of like, I don't see there's a proverb that says that basically a man who is stupid, basically, is like a dog that returns to eat his own vomit. That's kind of a gross statement. But the bottom line is, I don't think these guys are going to go back and say, hey, we're going to embrace the far left. I think that most of them are moderately left. I think probably almost all of them are. But I think they've also, look at the parade of people that have gone from being Democrats to being Republicans. Go all the way back to Lincoln, go back to Eisenhower, people like that, that were like, okay, we're not going to support the far left. Back then, they didn't have the far left like they do now. So anyway, my observations, I was impressed with the speeches. I kind of still hate the fact that he really bashes previous presidents. I wish he wouldn't do that, but that's just the way Trump is. The issue is, what is it going to change? And I do think that this bill's, maybe this is something we'll build out over the next few shows. I do think there's going to be significant radical change in some areas. The things that I don't think he can stop are going to be the government marching on in terms of its debt. Now, even though we have Elon Musk apparently is going to have free reign because now he's fully in charge of Dodge, the Department of Government Efficiency. There's only so many things he can cut, and we'll probably talk about this in the next few weeks. If you look at the things he can't cut, the things that he can't cut are more, by far, bigger part of the budget than the things that he has the potential to cut. So while I'm all in favor of government efficiency, 100%, everything he could do to cut, I think that we're going to be limited. The big limitations are what's coming in the entitlements and the fact that we've already accumulated $36 trillion of debt, and the interest rates on those are not likely to go down. If you look at what's going on, we've had a period of time from 1981, and we'll talk about this if we have time in the second half of the show, getting to what I believe is a fallacy about the 60-40 blend. The bottom line is that interest rates for most of our lives and most of my professional career have been falling. I don't believe that's the way it's going to be in the future. Alan Greenspan said that the coming decade will be one of rising inflation, stagflation like the 1970s. And so far, that's proving to be very prophetic. So number one, I don't see the entitlements will be cut. We're not going to, we know that Social Security, Medicare run out of money in 2032 or three. And that's probably the optimistic viewpoint. And that's not going to happen. Nobody's going to just go, all you seniors that are on Social Security, we're going to cut your paycheck by 25% in a single day. That's pretty unlikely. Now, what will end up happening, though, unfortunately, I think, because Trump has not mentioned he's planning on touching it, is it's going to, the way these things work in politics in Washington, it's probably going to come down to the last minute before they decide how to fix the problem. And it's a looming crisis. It's a looming crisis that's going to have to be fixed. The bigger issue, though, is Medicare. That's the 800-pound gorilla. As the boomers get older and older, that's going to factor into the health care costs. They're going to be astronomical and accelerating in Medicare. Medical expenses, medical treatments are getting more complicated and more expensive all the time. That's not going to turn around. The interest on the $36 trillion in debt, which even with the best efforts of Elon Musk and Trump, I think the interest on the national debt, it'll slow down this year, almost certainly. Even in spite of the California wildfires, there were huge profits in the stock market last year that people end up paying capital gains tax on. So we may have a little bit of a remission on the galloping national debt for 2025. But the issue is still, if you look at the longer term trajectory, it's not going to change. You're going to continue. You have a slowdown this year, but the national debt over the next 10 to 15 years is going to still skyrocket if you look at where the numbers are headed. So I'm not, again, not trying to be negative, not trying to pour cold water on this thing. But I think that we've got to go back to being brutally honest in our assessment of our current reality, having unwavering faith that we prevail in the end. If you look at the book we've talked about many, many, many times. It's called The Fourth Turning. That's number four. The good news, here's the good news that I see. In each of those times when America was facing a crisis of existential magnitude, that would have been King Philip's War in the 1670s, all-out Indian uprising, the Patriots at first were ignoring the calls and warnings by the preachers and leaders of the day. Then the war was so incredible. It was biggest loss of life on a percentage basis in U.S. history. Then we had the Revolutionary War. Then we had the Civil War. We had World War II and the Great Depression. All these were previous eras of fourth turning. And again, I don't intend to spend a whole lot of time on this today. We can do more on that in future issues, future editions. But the bottom line is, in each one of those cases, one day I noticed that when I was going back over it for about the 20th time, I noticed that in each case, the wrong side won at first. The wrong side of history won. And then once the crisis had reached a certain point, it turned. I think that's where we are right now. I think that the American people have decided they're fed up with the far left constituency and all the craziness that they put on Facebook and all the sexual perversion, all the sexual, you know, distortions of gender and just all the insanity. People have decided this is not the way we want to go. The hardcore left, they're not going to change, most likely. Some of them might change, but probably not. But I think what we've got to do is celebrate the changes that we're seeing from this new president. And I think they're going to be significant. And I think they're going to be very good changes. But again, what I see happening is a shift in the battle. Because if you look at the last 4 years, to me, all I can say is this, that era of governance, we were losing the war. In my view, the right side of history was losing the war, but people got fed up with that. This is probably like Jimmy Carter, you know, preceding Ronald Reagan in a lot of ways. I think that that's the kind of history this probably entails, because people decided they did not like the Biden administration's actions. They did not like Kamala Harris. They didn't like anything that came. And so they rejected that and went in what I think is more the right direction. And I'm not saying I agree with Trump on everything. I certainly wouldn't. But the bottom line is, I think that a revolution in some ways is taking place. And I think it's going to be profound and have lasting impact on America over the long run. It's just that it's not, the war is not finished. We can't just sit on our duff and go, well, we won, it's over. No, the far left is not going to just sit there and take this. And, you know, even when we were driving home or driving to the airport in Washington in a cab, turned out cab was way less expensive than the Freebird guys, you know, the
Uber,
the Uber and Lyft and stuff. I'm like, okay. I guess the demand of the time, everybody went to Uber anyway. The cab was one third of the price. I'm like, okay, didn't know that was going to happen. But the bottom line, we're listening to the radio and he had it on CBS News and they were still absolute negative bashing Trump about whatever it was at the time. And I'm like, okay, there's some people you're just not going to turn them. You're just not going to change them. The only way that I know of to get rid of them is to bankrupt them, and that's not happening right now, but some of them seem to be going in that direction. I know that there's a change in the, I read recently, just a couple of nights ago, or maybe last night, about the shift at CNN. They got a new sheriff in town. He said, you're not going to do it the way we've done it before. Why? Well, it's clear. They've lost market share. They've lost, you know, their... The combination of CNN and MSNBC together is about half of the audience of Fox. And it's just a matter of the Fox guys are just blasting them. And Fox is trying to stay fair and balanced, quote unquote, whatever that means. But the bottom line is, I think that the far left is losing the war. And I think over time, it's going to work. But at the same time, I'm not going to underestimate how difficult the war is going to be, because there's still a lot more to come. And I think that in my view, Trump is probably the man for the job for this era. I have a heart. It's just difficult for me to imagine how much he's already been through and to come out as strong as he is right now, especially at his age, at 78 years old, just amazing. So my view of the inauguration, Pretty real positive all the way around. I wish he wouldn't bash his enemies, especially when they're sitting on stage with him, but that's the way he is. And that's just, you take the good with the bad. So the bottom line is, I think there's a great turning point in history that we've just been through.
Well, we've said in the past that we like Trump for the economy and the markets, but not so much his talking. He could use somebody else to do the speaking for him at times. But I do like your reference to the change from Carter to Reagan when it comes to the market and the economy. That was a big shift. That was the start of some really good times for the market and for the economy. So hopefully that wasn't just a reference you came up with in your head just for Trump transition, but for also the economy. And speaking of which, let's make that transition. Let's talk about the economy and the markets and give our updates on what we see going. There's a really good article this week by Ned Davis Research titled Follow the Trends, Not the Noise, or Focus, excuse me, on the Trends, Not the Noise. We had some good information from that. It's good advice. Where would you like to start, Jerry?
I think I want to start out with the interest rate environment because it's going to have such a big role on the stock market and the economy. And so this is part of what I don't see having a big change. It's very clear, in my opinion, if you look at the past way that inflation has affected our country, you've had periods of time where you've had previous inflation. Now, I would make the case that from 1981 until COVID, that this was the exception to the rule. If you look at interest rates and inflation, and if you look at the effect it had on the economy, the bond market, the stock market, you name it, going back to World War II, from the end of World War II until 1981, you had 40 plus years of rising interest rates and rising inflation. It never subsided. You had wave after wave, but then every time you have an up wave, you'd had a down wave on the other side. That's where I think we are today. I don't think that we've defeated inflation, and I don't, frankly don't think we're going to. The issue is that inflation, I believe, will come back. Now, most of you have heard me talk about Alan Greenspan and his quote. And he said this again in 2017, and he was out beating the bushes. He was out on every talk show that would have him on. He was beating the bushes saying, hey, warning, warning, Will Robinson, to go back to, the space show from the early 60s, Lost in Space. But the bottom line is he was saying the next decade will not be like this previous decade. It's not going to be like the one we're in now. But the next decade will be unlike anything we've seen since the 1970s, which was stagflation, meaning slower economic growth with higher and running inflation. Now, I'm not going to argue with the guy. He's the second longest running Fed president in history, and he made that statement. And so far, it's proven to be virtually prophetic, prescient. It's because that's what we started out with. Now, he couldn't have predicted COVID. Nobody predicted COVID in 2017. But you could see, in a way, you could see the things building. We were coming out of a deflationary crisis that nearly got all the way to a Great Depression. But with the invention of quantitative easing and all the other things that they did, Ben Bernanke, coincidentally, I don't think it was a coincidence, was the greatest expert by most people's book on the Great Depression in the 1930s, and he had an arsenal of what he wanted to unleash, and he did it, and it actually worked. It pulled the real estate markets out of the Grand Canyon. It pulled the stock market out. But the bottom line is we faced a deflationary undertow essentially from the 2008 crash until COVID. So we had this undertow of deflation. So in other words, if you ever been to the ocean and you looked, and of course we spent some time over the holidays down at the ocean in our little RV. Bottom line is you could walk the beach and you can see early in the mornings, you can see where high tide was. High tide, okay, the water got all the way up to here. Now it's 50 feet down, further down back into the ocean, but you had a high tide. So the issue is the tides come and the tides go. In the 2008 to 2020 timeframe, that was a time when the tide was going out. Now the tide is coming back in. And even though the tide, you're going to have waves along the way, the tide is coming in for higher inflation. And I don't see that changing over the next decade. So in other words, if you look at, and the bond market is frankly telling you this, the bond market for the most part is, most people estimate, about five times larger than the stock market. So it's all institution. It's dominated by institutional players. It's not dominated by, you don't have a whole lot of wild, set your hair on fire, crazy speculators in the bond market. It's used for pensions. It's used, so if you think of CPAs, you know, with their, in the old days, they had the green shade, you know, it's dominated by very conservative investors, and they're looking at the future. And right now, here's what the government bond interest rates, even though the Fed cut rates starting in September, interest rates have not gone down meaningfully. They went down for a little while. They're back up near where they were before the Fed rate cuts. That, to me, is not a coincidence, number one. And number two, I don't believe it's going to go away. In other words, I'm not saying that this wave of inflation is going to push interest rates a lot higher in the short run. I think that's unlikely. I think the next 18 months, at least, you're going to see interest rates under control, with a downward tilt occasionally, because I don't think inflation is going to get radically accelerating from here, but I don't think inflation's done for the decade either. But here's what the government bond markets are looking at, because investors, remember how the bond market works. Every day, essentially, every month, the government has to issue more debt. Why? Because we have a $36 trillion budget deficit. Now, what does that mean? That means that from George Washington until today, when Trump took office, the government has overspent its income 97% of the time. That's an approximation. I don't have that stat, but it's about right. There was a brief period of time when Gingrich was in office and Clinton was in office where they, quote, balanced the budget, unquote. But even at that time, the Social Security and Medicare expenses were off the books. If you added Social Security and Medicare back in, the national debt didn't go down. You know, if you truly balance the books the way everybody else expects what a balance the books would mean, you would not increase the national debt. You would say, okay, the national debt actually went down because we balanced the books and we had a big surplus caused by all the people that were selling their dot-com stocks in that time. And that's almost essentially, the Wall Street Journal did a great article on that, hey, the bottom line is we wouldn't have had a budget surplus, quote unquote, if they hadn't have been paying capital gains tax on huge gains on the guys that sold, like Mark Cuban, and had to pay capital gains tax on their dot-com profits. So the issue is a lot of people lost money on the dot-coms. Most people probably did, because most people bought near the top, but the smarter guys, which were typically the founders and the principals, a lot of them sold and incurred enormous capital gains tax, which temporarily balanced the budget. Bottom line, though, is I would emphasize temporary. So if you look at what happened, we had a temporary balancing the budget with Gingrich in there. They were emphasizing we wanted to balance the budget. It worked for a few moments, and then we went back to business as usual, and the deficits just went off the charts. So here's what the long-term bond market is looking at. They're looking at tariffs, which could be inflationary, at least in the short run. They're looking at a very tight labor market, historically tight, which means wage pressure is going to be going up. They're looking at a supply shortage on housing, which is, you know, estimates are 3 or 4 million houses short. Money supply is starting to rise again, which eventually that causes more inflation, not right away. Looking at electricity demand outstripping supply with AI, they're estimating we're going to need at least 2 to 3 times the amount of electricity in 5 years that we need today. Some estimates are 400% higher. And the government spending is going to continue going up. So the issue is the bond market is telling us we're not going back to where we were a decade ago. This is a new normal. When we come back from the break, we'll talk more about what this new normal means and the market, and a little bit possibly on the 60-40 plan.
All right. Well, I wanted to take this small break to remind you how to learn more about us here at Cornerstone Financial. You can find us at cornerstonereport.com. That's cornerstonereport.com. You can look up information about us, catch previous radio shows. If you missed a recent interview, they're found there also, just under the Smart Money Radio tab. You can see Jerry's special reports all there at cornerstonereport.com. And if you'd like to reach out to us for a consultation, please give us a call at 1-800-327-4285. That's 800-327-4285. 727-427-4285. And just give you a heads up, we're planning some more interviews in the near future. We have people like the founder of EPB Research. You hear us quote them quite often. He's coming up soon. I am in talks with BCA about getting Matt Gerken back on our radio soon. He does a great job with geopolitics, including American politics, how this recent election is going to affect the market and the economy, his outlook on Trump's policies and what may or may not happen. I was able to attend a luncheon with him last week, and he's got a lot of great information we'd like to try to get to you and others. So we've got a lot of good interviews coming up for you. And again, if you missed some previous ones, we have one with Matthew Ike of U.S. Energy talking about the energy sector and his outlook on our website, cornerstonereport.com. We've got Ed Seeley with Paul Borowski talking about, you know, basically the U.S. supply chain. How it's all shifting from China over to French shoring or even local shoring. And then we've got information with Adam Larson with Cottonwood about the commercial real estate, the outlook, how it has struggled in the past couple of years, but the outlook going forward, how it is actually looking pretty positive. So again, you can find those on our website, cornerstonereport.com. All right, Jerry, well, before we took that little break, we're talking about interest rates and how your outlook short term, you know, inflation looks like it may be under, it's sticky, but under control. Longer term, we may have an issue in the second half of the decade with inflation and how that affects all the interest rates.
And I think that's what we're seeing clearly again, Michael, in the short run. If you look at the government bond market and yields on government bonds, the short term, you know, the 2-year bond is going to be reflecting what the Fed's doing, because it's short term by nature. The longer term 10-year to 30-year bonds are going to be reacting differently. And what the bond market is seeing right now, because again, it's more astute investors typically than the average stock market investor, although clearly a lot of the people that are in the stock market are very astute. The bond market as a whole is not only 5 times bigger, but if the average participant is more astute, that's what I would say. So they're looking at the tariffs. Those are inflationary. They could be, you know, deflationary if we go into recession. I just don't think that's likely. I don't think Trump's going to push the tariffs that hard. In comparison to the past, he's going to use them more for negotiating. And I do think he's going to get out the big stick if he has to. But I also think a lot of the countries out there are going to go, okay, we don't want the stick. Let's see what we can do and make a deal, quote unquote, like Mexico and Canada appear to be already trying to do. The tight labor market is not going to go away. It's a demographic issue. That's why we wrote our book From Boom to Bust and Beyond, because again, the baby boomers are retiring en masse, 10,000 a day. And essentially you're not able to make up for their productivity, no matter how many young people there are in the Gen Zs and the millennials. Over time, they will make that up, but not in the short run. The housing supply, again, we're very undersupplied in housing. Estimates I've seen, normal estimates, 3 million or 4 million houses short of what we need to house America in the future. The money supply is going up. Again, that is inflationary after a season of time. There's a lag time involved there. And then the electricity demand, energy is going to be a boom, I believe, for the second half of the decade. Again, they're talking about 300 or 400% increase in energy need just for AI. And then, of course, we have the government spending, the budget deficits, which they're not going to, they'll probably recede some this year due to the capital gains tax, due to the economy going back up. But again, those factors are all problematic for the bond market, and the bond market has an influence on the stock market. So if we look at stocks, you know, the real risks that we're seeing right now, the biggest one right now that I see outside geopolitics, and we had this discussion, Michael, you were able to attend the Matt Gerken seminar, and Matt, of course, is a geopolitical expert for Bank Credit Analyst. He said one of the biggest risks is what happens if Israel decides this is our opportune time to attack Iran after we've dealt with the Houthis are now knuckling under because of Trump. Then you've got Hezbollah and Hamas. This might be our best opportunity to try to take out their nuclear facility. Now, I don't know if that's going to happen or not. I don't know what odds that Matt Gerken puts on that, but that's a definite black swan type of geopolitical risk. If that doesn't happen.
I would say he doesn't see it as a perhaps. He sees Israel, sees it as this is the time to deal with Iran. He said even if Netanyahu stepped down from office and somebody from the opposite political view joined as the leader, they would still have the view that this is the time to deal with Iran.
I think this is the time.
Trump's going to have a really hard time handling that. That he thinks
trying to talk them
Trump
down.
Can handle Iran. He can negotiate Iran, but getting Iran and Israel both to calm down at the same time is going to be really tough.
Could be. And that's then in my view, that would be the primary risk for the market this year. Now, again, the market is very overvalued if you look at history. But that's one of the things we've talked about before is the fact that the issue here, there's multiple issues going on. Valuation, stocks being expensive, historically speaking, if you look back to the 60s, if you look back to the 70s, 80s, even the 2000 era, were more expensive than we were in 2000 based on almost any criteria you want to use. But valuations are not good timing indicators. They're risk indicators. And I would make the case, if a black swan like Iran and Israel does not happen, then the economy looks like it's expanding from here. We've seen, you know, we had this chart in our newsletter in September. You know, every time that the unemployment rate has breached a certain level of acceleration, it's gone on to cause a recession. Right now, that hasn't happened. And without a black swan event, I don't see that it probably will happen. We were looking at one of the Ned Davis charts earlier, their economic chart. And it was basically the economic cycle. And I look back on it, 11 out of previous 11 times, when you reached a point, a negative point, you know, if you have, imagine a zero axis in the middle, once you get down below minus 10, minus 20, you've had 11 recessions out of 11 occurrences since 1948. So we're bucking the trend here, Bucko. It's like, okay, but that doesn't mean that it can't be the exception to the rule. It's just like, you know, usually you don't want to bet everything on exceptions to the rule. So we passed that point, but now we're back up again. Now we're past the midpoint where you'd say, okay, now you're not at risk of a recession at this point. So I would say without that, without the geopolitical issue jumping in and grabbing a hold of everything, odds are that we're recovering from here. Probably have a weak first quarter because of the polar vortex. Whatever happened to global warming, Michael? I can't figure out what happened to that. As a matter of fact, I think I saw a recent, it was on Facebook, and you can't always trust those, but it was a quote from Al Gore from, like, you know, his first book written in the 1990s, I believe. He said, by the year 2000, we won't even have winters anymore. I'm like, really? Okay, well, I think they're a little wrong on that side of it, too.
Tell Florida that.
But yeah, tell Florida that. You know, 2019, 2014, 2011, we had one negative quarter of negative GDP. The weather and California rebuilding California in the long run will be positive for GDP. In the short run, it's negative for the next quarter or two. So we did have a strong fourth quarter. Payrolls, industrial production, and retail sales all were solid and above expectations. The real GDP or inflation-adjusted GDP came in at about 3% annualized in the fourth quarter. So none of these things are recessionary. The recessionary precursors all turned negative and all have kind of stopped. They haven't gone back up and started going up again. They've just stopped going down. And that, of course, is a good sign. So the question is, I think the data in January might be somewhat negative with the weather problems and the wildfires, but it doesn't look like it's going to be anything near enough to push us into recession. Like I said, the Ned Davis model has crossed the point where from here on out, it should be strong positively. The ITR Bolio Brothers, we need to see if we can get them back on the show here in the near future. Their models are all saying growth for 2025. Purchasing manager index, new orders are up. So right now, the real risks to me are mostly the geopolitical issues, something happening out of the ordinary, earnings per shares starting out well, the financials, basically the big banks starting out well. If we end up with a 1994 scenario, and you may not remember 1994, those of you that aren't as in deep to the market as I am, But the bottom line is Fed under Alan Greenspan raised interest rates, I want to say 15 times in 1994. And they were smaller incremental raises, but still that had a negative impact on the stock market for that entire year. But it kind of compressed it. We went into a historic earnings growth with the internet and the dot-coms, and we had 5 years of smooth sailing. But what's the difference in this time and that time? So there are some similarities, but as we quote Yogi Berra quite often, the similarities, Yogi Berra's son, the similarities are different. So the issue here is that, yes, but we went into a historic growth boom. We had the internet. We had a new technology. We have a similar type of game changer type technology with artificial intelligence this time. Yes, sounds very familiar. The issue is we did not have valuations anywhere close to where we are now. And I do think it makes sense. A lot of people have made the case, and I would agree with this, that to some extent, the economy has changed. If you go back to 1966, we had a soft landing then. If you go back to the 60s, the 30s, the 50s, the 70s, whatever era you want to go back to, stocks, in terms of how do you value how expensive a stock is, earnings per share, typically there are various ways to slice and dice that, but earnings per share are typically the way that you would look. How much is this company making? It's what's the earnings of the company divided by the number of shares. That's your most reliable benchmark as to whether prices are too high or too low. Typically speaking, when prices get way too high in terms of their valuations are off the chart, which essentially they are right now, then you're going to have to either do one of two things. You're either going to have a bear market, which currently doesn't look likely, although I reserve the right to change my opinion later, especially if Israel and Iran get after it. That would be something that would completely disrupt the world economy. So the issue is right now, earnings per share are high. In other words, stocks are high, but they're not good timing mechanisms. They're risk indicators. But I would also make the case that we're more technology driven today. The economy is very different than it was when smokestacks dominated the U.S. economy, you know, back in the industrial days. In spite of Trump's best efforts, the number of people working in manufacturing over the past 50 years has continued to decline. It stopped plummeting in the last few years, but it's still low and it's not turned back up again. I just don't see that the U.S. has big advantages unless you're going to do it through tariffs. I don't see the advantages of building a big factory in the United States. Now, the ones that are being built are going into the red states. They're going into states that don't have outrageous, ridiculous overregulation and tax policies. So you are getting some movement that direction, but I just don't see that it's a wholesale takeover the world kind of move. It's going to be stemming the outflow more than massively booming in the industrial world in America. So if you look at inflation and what's going on here, inflation is subdued for now. I would emphasize that to me is for now. Every analyst that we're seeing, bank credit analysts, strategists, all of them believe, and they've seen this pattern. And here's the pattern with inflation. Typically speaking, you have a period of time where you go through these waves. The wave goes up, you have a big wave up of inflation, and then the wave subsides. And if your thinking is not in this, I could be wrong on this, obviously, but my thinking is different than what you would expect. You know, it's we talk about behavioral finance a lot. Behavioral finance recency is one of the dominant trigger points. They talk about this being what's called a heuristic. A heuristic is something where people are locked into one way of thinking that is incorrect. So if people are thinking we're going to go back to the types of price earnings ratios, the way the stock bond mix was, maybe we'll do another show on this in the near future. The bottom line, if you go back to that type of thinking and say, oh, well, the 60-40 blend works just fine. Because why? The 40% of the bonds, that offsets the drops in the stock market when you have a crash. And so therefore, it gives you a much smoother ride. What if stagflation, as Alan Greenspan said, is the move of this decade, which I believe it is, then the bond side of the equation doesn't work well. you have periods of time like you had in 2022, 2023, where bonds and stocks were both going down. As one person said, there was no place to hide. Why? Because stocks were going down and bonds were going down. Interest rates were rising and it was hurting both stocks and bonds. So what you see right now is that the bond market is really ultra, ultra, ultra sensitive to movements in the interest rate market. Because again, it's very simple. Imagine a long-term bond. If you owned a bond at 4% for 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, and interest rates went up to 6, by definition, that means that the new bonds being issued at 6% are worth a lot more than a bond issued at 4. And your bond you bought at 4, unless you hold it to maturity, if you try to sell it, you're going to get a haircut, probably about a 20% haircut on the bond. You're not supposed to be losing money in your bond portfolio. That's not the purpose of the bonds. The purpose of the bonds is to be the defense. So one of the things we'll be talking about in multiple shows coming up and interviewing some of our new managers we've just hired is, okay, there are faulty ways, in my opinion, to do diversification. I do believe in diversification. Ecclesiastes 11 talks about divide your assets into 7, yes, 8, for you do not know what disaster might befall the land and which will do better, this or that. So diversification to me is an absolute principle that makes sense, works in the financial markets, but there are different ways to do it. You don't have to do it the way it's traditionally been done. And I would make a strong case that you can't do it that way, in my view, over the next decade and work out well. So the issue is there are other ways to diversify besides doing just throwing, you know, throw the paint on the wall and hope it sticks. You know, so the issue is the areas, if you look at stocks, for example, the United States has been dominant for 30 years on the stock market. Compare that to the international market, compare it to Europe, compare it to Japan. International diversification has not worked. International diversification worked really well when Bush was in office. We had a one-time massive move in the international marketplace in the developing markets driven by China, bringing 14, 15 million people a year to the cities, and China had a massive boom. Well, that's not where we are right now. China is now in a massive bust, and they're still not making up for that, and it's got a ways to run. Probably several more years before they fully deflate their housing bubble. So the traditional way of looking at it is international. Oh, we've got to do international. Maybe not. What about small caps? They've underperformed for 30 years. Maybe that changes. But right now, you know, the big stocks in America have been the dominant. If you look compared to Europe, compared to any of the markets in Europe, the S&P 500 has dominated the returns globally. So how are you going to get that diversification? I think you're going to have to do it with a different methodology. That different methodology to me is more of a tactical market approach, meaning you have a model and the purpose of the model is to get you out of harm's way when the bear market hits. Because again, I don't think the traditional 60-40 bond smooth ride is going to be performing the same way that it did in the last time. So at this point in time, all the analysts that we're looking at are projecting inflation to accelerate again in a second wave. If you look at the history of inflation, once you let the genie out of the box, so to speak, once Pandora's box of inflation is opened, what ends up happening is you don't have one wave. You typically, historically, past performance is never a guarantee of the future in finances, folks, but you don't have just one wave. You normally have two or three. Now, whether we'll have two or three, I don't know. But I think there's going to be another wave before the end of the decade. In spite of Trump and in spite of the Doge trying to cut expenses for the federal government. So right now, I believe that we're at the downside, the trough of that wave. And I think that probably lasts about 18 months-ish. And then I think it begins to go back up again. So if you're looking at different ways to manage money, there are different methodologies that you can use to provide the defense rather than the bonds. Because I think the bonds in the long run are going to be, you know, when we were kids, we used to take our school lunch and some of us had metal school, you know, metal pails that you put your lunch into the metal pail for lunches. And sometimes we used a paper bag. To me, counting on bonds being what bails you out. And I'm not saying they're not valuable for income. I'm just saying I think the world has changed with inflation. The bottom line is it may be like holding your lunch in a wet paper bag. It got wet on the bottom, and all of a sudden the whole thing fell out, and the sandwich and the lettuce and the tomatoes and everything went all over the floor. And so the bottom line is, I don't think that you should be thinking the traditional 60-40 blend will work in the future. I believe it will not work, number one, and I think it could be disastrous depending on what happens in the future. We'll just talk more about that as we go. So I think we're going to see a trough in inflation for the next 12 to 18 months. I think that that will be a different world that we're living through today than what we've seen in the past 30 years. We'll talk more about this as we go. More with Michael Williams, Jerry Tumo, Smart Money.
And before we go, I would like to remind you, if you'd like to call and talk to us and learn how it is in more detail, we go about diversification, where we're not just dependent upon bonds or international bonds or small caps, which don't look so positive right now. We'd be happy to talk to you about that. Give us a call at 1-800-327-4285. 800-327-4285.
Jerry Tuma Smart Money is a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services of Dallas, Texas. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Financial advisors at Cornerstone could help you if you prefer to delegate your investment decisions to a financial professional. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. We publish a newsletter, Cornerstone Report, which is available on our website or by calling our toll-free number at 800-327-4285. That's also the number to call for more information about anything we've discussed during today's broadcast. For more information, visit our website at cornerstonereport.com. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only. It should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. Remember, we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.